Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present James S. Henry, an economist and investigative journalist, who talks about the significance of the Greek people's July 5th referendum vote, overwhelmingly rejecting more EU austerity measures. Raleigh Hoke, campaign director with the Gulf Restoration Network, who assesses the recent $18.7 billion settlement reached with BP for damages caused by their enormous 2010 oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. And Wayne Smith, a 25-year veteran of the U.S. State Department, who reflects on the historic restoration of diplomatic relations between Washington and Havana and prospects for lifting the 55-year-old U.S. economic embargo against Cuba. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Witnesses tell the BBC that numerous schoolgirls who were kidnapped in Chibok in northern Nigeria by the Boko Haram terrorist group in April 2014 have been forcibly recruited into the radical Islamist militant group to fight for them. Claims of girls terrorizing other captives and carrying out killings themselves against non-Muslims has not yet been verified by Amnesty International. Several women who claim they were held in the same camps as the Chibok girls say some were brainwashed and now carry out so-called punishments on the militants' behalf. 17-year-old Miriam, not her real name, escaped after 6 months, but although she and four others refused to marry, the militants slit the throats of four male Christians and said this will happen to any girl who refuses marriage. Faced with that possibility, she then married a Boko Haram militant and is now pregnant. Miriam and others also claim they witnessed some of the girls kill several Christian men in the village by slitting their throats. She now faces a bleak future, being rejected by her family and community by being forced into a situation that was not her choice. Boko Haram has killed 5,500 estimated civilians in Nigeria and kidnapped at least 2,000 women and girls since the beginning of 2014. The search for the 219 Chibok schoolgirls continues. More than 25 years after the Velvet Revolution, which hastened the fall of the Soviet Union, some former Soviet states in Eastern Europe are reconsidering their alliance with the European Union. But member states from Warsaw to Budapest and Sofia to Prague look uneasily to Russia and how far President Vladimir Putin will push his foreign policy and his discontent with the West. Although no one expects an invasion or change of allegiances between the East and West, not everyone feels equally content. Many have placed their support behind populist leaders like Czech President Miloš Zeman and Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orbán. Historically, Hungary has leaned east or west for centuries, and some are concerned about its present leaning toward Russia. Czech journalist Andrej Sukop said, "Basically, I think that it's really the first time since 1989 that we've started a discussion about do we really belong to the West and what the West really is." On June 3rd, the Republican majority in North Carolina state legislature overturned GOP Governor Pat McCrory's veto of the so-called AGAG law, or House Bill 405. The bill varies from state to state, but the motive is the same: to criminalize people who blow the whistle on animal abuse, labor violations, groundwater pollution, and other malpractice. Effective January 1, 2016, it will be illegal for an employee to record images or sound occurring within an employer's premises and that the employee has entered the premises without the intent of carrying out their employment. Unattended cameras are also barred. According to the news magazine In These Times, AGAG laws target animal rights groups like Mercy for Animals, PETA, the Humane Society, and Compassion over Killing. These groups hire undercover investigators to seek part-time employment within the meat industry, puppy mills, research labs, circuses, or zoos to expose abuses and have gained worldwide exposure. Vandana Bala, general counsel for Mercy for Animals, calls undercover investigations the only meaningful and effective watchdogs of the animal agriculture industry and serve as an absolute crucial role in protecting these animals. The law extends even to journalists who publicize illegally obtained recordings. And although this is centered on animal rights, the law extends and the same penalties would apply to whistleblowing employees in all industries, from daycare centers to nursing homes. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
In the face of imminent default on its $320 billion debt and enormous pressure to reach an agreement with its European Union creditors, the Greek people overwhelmingly rejected the imposition of new austerity measures in a historic July 5th referendum. The 61.3% of Greeks who cast ballots for a no vote confirmed majority national support for the governing Syriza party's pledge to challenge harsh Eurozone austerity measures when it won power last January. Eurozone leaders warned that the results of the referendum had not changed the EU's insistence that Greece adopt tough structural economic reforms in exchange for a third bailout package. But Syriza party leader and Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras believes the referendum victory, along with support from most opposition parties, strengthens his negotiating position in a new round of talks. There's much at stake in upcoming negotiations as Greek banks teeter on the brink of insolvency and unknown consequences for the European Union if Greece is forced to leave the euro and return to its old currency, the drachma. While there's disagreement on what the outcome may be, there's no doubt there's more pain ahead for the Greek people, who have already suffered through 5 years of severe depression that has brought 25% unemployment and a 23% reduction in the national budget. Your reporter spoke with James S. Henry, an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist. Henry, former chief economist at the international consultancy firm McKinsey & Company, who is now a senior fellow at Columbia University's Center for Sustainable International Investment, discusses the significance of the outcome of the Greek referendum and the major issues in the difficult negotiations ahead.
Well, I think the Greek people have had 6 years of austerity under the EU and the ECB, the European Central Bank, the IMF. The debt ratio has actually increased to more than 180% of GDP, and they've seen dramatic reductions in income per capita, 25% unemployment, pensions down 44%, and 20% of the population requiring food aid. They've said enough is enough. We've tried the bloodletting approach to cutting spending and raising sales taxes, VAT taxes, under the latest proposal from the EU would go to from the Eurogroup would go to 23%, and they resoundingly said 61.3% said no to the latest term sheet from the Eurogroup, basically saying no more austerity. So this is on top of a new IMF report about 10 days ago, which basically threw in the towel. I mean, said austerity has not worked. Maybe it's your fault, maybe it's ours, but basically, what the Greek people need is much more substantial debt relief, better terms, and some new concessions. And so, in fact, most of the major economists around the planet are agreeing that the EU is, and Germany in particular, which is kind of behind this whole scene, is acting in a kind of stubborn and intransigent way, that the European Central Bank has not behaved like a central bank. They haven't stood behind the banks here. They basically put a cap on how much lending they would do to the banking system there. You know, so there's a short-term currency crisis in the country. I think independent objective observers would say, look, Greece is objectively bankrupt. And if you were a private company like General Motors in 2010, we basically allowed them to go Chapter 11, and we shared the burden of restructuring their debt with creditors, had to take a substantial debt reduction. Unfortunately, we don't have any international bankruptcy courts for governments, and that's been a major problem for the international system for the last 30 years, and Greece is just the latest example of that. If you compare the United States, which has an unemployment rate now below 5.5%, with the EU, which is still above 10, and the southern European countries, unemployment north of 20 to 25% in Italy and Greece and Spain, it's clear that the hyper-austerity program pushed basically by the German finance minister, has been a failure.
James, here's a question. By withdrawing support for Greek banks in advance of the referendum vote, were the leaders of the European Commission, the European Central Bank, and the IMF attempting to intimidate Greek voters into casting ballots, undermining Alexis Tsipras of the Syriza party, and thereby aiding in the removal of his party from power in Greece?
I think this was simply about politics. It's not about economics. Essentially, they were hoping that Greek population would vote yes in favor of retaining the euro. Most Greeks want to retain the euro. They've had terrible experiences with hyperinflation when the Germans occupied the country in the 40s, and they don't want to go back to the drachma. But what they do want is debt relief. So, yes, it was a blatant attempt to unseat the left-wing government that came in January, because the Euro group has its eyes not on Greece. They have their eyes on Spain, which has a 1.1 trillion euro debt, on Italy, which has a 2.1 trillion euro debt, and on Portugal. In all of these governments, all of these situations, the left is on the rise, simply because Europe-wide, even countries like Finland, have suffered from this hyper-austerity program that the EU has been pushing.
James Henry, what do you believe the effect of this no vote in Greece will have across Europe, especially for supporters of left anti-austerity parties like Podemos in Spain, which has been garnering a lot of support these days, and in other countries such as Italy, Portugal, and Ireland? What's the message that comes out of Greece for these folks?
Well, that's part of the issue here. You know, we're really waiting to see what impact this no vote has on the European system. In principle, it basically says, you know, the statistics today were interesting. If you look at middle and lower income voters in Greece, the statistics are, you know, that 70% of lower income Greeks voted against austerity. So this is becoming a bit of a class war. And I think, you know, each one of these economies is in a slightly different position. We've seen some return to economic growth in Spain this year, as well as in Italy. So it's not quite as dire a situation in those cases. But there's no question that Podemos and, the left in Italy are taking, sort of seeing this as a positive sign for their anti-austerity programs. And so I think, you know, if the EU again wants to be short-sighted about this, they'll, reject any compromises. But what's really needed to depolarize the situation is some debt relief for the Greeks.
That was James S. Henry, an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist, who is now a senior fellow at Columbia University's Center for Sustainable International Investment. Find more perspectives on the Greek debt crisis and upcoming negotiations by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On July 2nd, a little over 5 years after an explosion aboard the Deepwater Horizon oil rig killed 11 workers and spilled 4.9 million barrels of crude oil into the waters of the Gulf of Mexico, British Petroleum, the company largely found responsible, agreed to an $18.7 billion settlement for all federal, state, and local environmental damage claims against it. Although this is the largest environmental settlement in U.S. history, the company, had it not decided to settle, could have faced claims amounting to twice as much. Under the agreement, BP would pay the federal government a civil penalty of $5.5 billion under the Clean Water Act over a 15-year time frame, and pay $7.1 billion under the Natural Resource Damage Assessment to the Gulf, which is meant to compensate for direct environmental harm caused by the spill. While the deal reached awards a substantial amount of money, many environmental advocates have serious concerns about how much of this money is actually going to be allocated towards restoring the Gulf's environment and impacted communities. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Raleigh Hoke, campaign director with the Gulf Restoration Network. Here he explains how the settlement was reached and concerns that remain about how the money will be spent.
We're still seeing the impacts of the BP disaster. You know, over 5 years later, we're still seeing oil wash up on our shores. There's major concerns about the impacts on dolphins and low fish and shrimp counts. And, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty about what the future holds. So we're urgently in need of these funds to get down to the business of restoring the Gulf. And while it's disappointing to see that this is only an $18.7 billion settlement, it certainly could have been higher. The positive on this is that we can now start spending this money in the next 2, 3, 5, 10 years rather than wait for possibly even decades as these legal appeals go on.
So who is actually going to be spending the money?
The two biggest environmental restoration portions of the settlement are Clean Water Act fines and then natural resource damage assessment fines. And those are going to be distributed according to various laws, the Oil Pollution Act and the Restore Act, primarily through state and federal decision makers.
There's, I think, several hundred million dollars in the settlement to deal with problems that haven't manifested yet. Any way of knowing if that would be enough money?
Yeah, so one of the big concerns with this settlement is it's unclear how we'll address, as of yet, undiscovered damages to the Gulf. There's $232 million set aside to address unknown natural resource damages, but that's not nearly enough if you look at the lessons of the Exxon Valdez disaster.
$18.7 billion seems like a lot of money. Isn't it the biggest environmental settlement in American history and maybe in the world?
You know, this is the largest environmental settlement in U.S. history, but this was also the largest environmental disaster in U.S. history and major long-term impacts on the Gulf of Mexico, and there are significant restoration needs. So this settlement, while $18.7 billion seems like a really big sum, only about two-thirds of that is actually being set aside for environmental restoration. And the Clean Water Act fines within that settlement is only $5.5 billion, which if it had gone through the trial process, that could have been up to $14 billion in Clean Water Act fines.
So, Raleigh Hoke, during my 4 trips to the Gulf after Hurricane Katrina, I talked to a lot of people with ideas about what should be done to restore the Gulf and the wetlands. You know, some were talking about rebuilding the barrier islands that have been washed away. Others were saying it's critical to let the Mississippi River once again deposit sediment along its length and build up land that way, rather than confine the river between channels so all the sediment gets dropped into the deep Gulf water.
Well, the Gulf of Mexico, well before the BP disaster, had significant environmental challenges. And one of the most significant is the disappearance of Louisiana's coastal wetlands. We lose a football field worth of wetlands every hour. And this isn't just about the environment. This is about us being able to continue to reside in southeast Louisiana. Communities like New Orleans are protected from storm surge and from hurricanes by those wetlands, and they're disappearing. Now, the state has come up with a $50 billion master plan for restoring our coast. And, you know, these funds, this $18.7 billion, a significant portion of that could go to helping to put this plan into place and, you know, begin this restoration effort on a significant scale. And we, you know, this is like a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to jumpstart restoration in Louisiana, and we really need to not squander this opportunity.
So this settlement has nothing to do with all the billions that have already been paid out to individuals and businesses for their losses due to the Deepwater Horizon disaster, right?
Yeah, so there's also been an economic claims process, and that's ongoing. I think they just closed down the ability to file claims a couple weeks ago. And that's for folks who were businesses or individuals who were economically harmed from the BP disaster. But this $18.7 billion, most of it is focused on environmental restoration. So it's the Clean Water Act fines and the natural resource damage assessment are the biggest chunk of that $18.7 billion. And that should be focused on environmental restoration, though I will say that, you know, we have major concerns about how our politicians in the Gulf states are looking at this money as a windfall to, you know, fund whatever their favorite pet project is.
What would stop the politicians from doing that?
Well, I think, you know, ultimately it's about holding them accountable to their constituents and people, you know, watchdogging this process. Even though we're 5 years out from the BP disaster and, you know, you don't see that oil spewing into the Gulf on the CNN live feed or anything, we still have major issues. As a public, as citizens, we have to pay attention to this process and weigh in to make sure that we hold these folks accountable for using that money for restoring the Gulf, not for pork barrel spending.
That was Raleigh Hoke of the Gulf Restoration Network. Find more news and commentary on the Gulf oil spill settlement by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Last December, President Obama announced his administration's historic decision to restore full diplomatic relations with Cuba's communist government. The breakthrough, negotiated with the help of Pope Francis over 18 months, ended the Cold War in the Caribbean 23 years after the fall of the Soviet Union. For decades, Washington's hardline policy toward Cuba had been rejected by the entire Latin American continent and the world. In October 2014, the United Nations General Assembly voted for the 23rd year in a row to condemn America's economic embargo against Cuba, with only Israel voting with the U.S. Domestic U.S. politics was one major factor that kept an obsolete policy in place so long after Washington had normalized relations with other once hostile nations, including Vietnam and China. While throughout the Cold War years, a strong majority of Cuban Americans living in the key electoral swing state of Florida had opposed restoring relations with Cuba, polls now find a majority support the Obama administration's new Cuba policy. On July 1st, U.S. and Cuban officials announced an agreement to open their nation's respective embassies in Washington and Havana on July 20th, ending 54 years of diplomatic isolation. Your reporter spoke with Wayne Smith, a 25-year veteran of the U.S. State Department, who served as executive secretary of President Kennedy's Latin American Task Force and chief of mission at the U.S. Interest Section in Havana from 1978 to 1982. Now a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy, Smith shares his views on the recent restoration of diplomatic relations between Washington and Havana and the prospects for lifting the 55-year U.S. economic embargo against Cuba.
I was there when we broke relations, pulled a flag down and sailed out. So I really feel very strongly about putting a flag back up. All these years, you know, I came back to Cuba in 1979 as chief of the U.S. Interest Section under Jimmy Carter. Carter had said he wanted a dialogue with Cuba. I did too. But Brzezinski, his national security advisor, did not want a dialogue or anything to do with Cuba and torpedoed every opportunity to have one. Then Ronald Reagan was elected. He wanted nothing to do with Cuba, that is. And so seeing that, I left the Foreign Service in 1982. I resigned and turned to professoring, and then in 1992 to being a consultant in the Center for International Policy. And during all those years then, from 1982 until last year, I worked to bring about some degree of dialogue with Cuba. I knew the Cubans. I was absolutely convinced we could have a sensible relationship. Not that everything would have been sweetness and light, of course. No, we would have had disagreements. But we also could have made progress in improving relations. But the administration would not give it an opportunity. Then Obama comes in, and last year, 2014, we began to move towards a relationship with Cuba. Thank goodness. I had thought I was going to go to my grave without ever seeing even an effort to have a dialogue with Cuba. But now we are. Now we're moving in that direction. Thank goodness.
Well, congratulations on your important role all these years in bringing this about, Wayne Smith. Lifting the U.S. economic embargo on Cuba will take an act of Congress, which is now controlled by the Republican Party. How likely are we to see normalization of trade with Cuba? And what factor do you think pressure by U.S. corporations will be as they're eager to sell goods to Cubans?
I think they will have increasing pressure, and again, as the Republican Congress realizes that they are isolated. No one agrees with them. Look, the polls indicate that the overwhelming percentage of Americans want normal relations with Cuba, and the overwhelming percentage of Cubans want normal relations, want to dialogue, want to negotiate, want to have trade. So if the Republicans want to hold out against the vast majority and make fools of themselves, well, fine. But I don't think they will. I think they're smarter than that, and that they will come around in time to a more sensible approach to Cuba. Not that everything will be sweetness and light, no. But at least we can talk. We can trade. We can reach agreements on things where it's in the interest of both sides to have agreements, and that's in so many cases.
Wayne, there is a long history of U.S. covert and overt efforts to overthrow or undermine the Cuban government.
Absolutely.
Including multiple assassination attempts targeting Fidel Castro. With this opening, will the U.S. stop, in your view, its attempt for regime change in Havana?
Absolutely. They had better. Better stop it and no more. No more. That's in the past. We can't continue to do that. Otherwise, the world will be totally against us. Look, giving back the Guantanamo naval base will be very difficult because there's still political prisoners there. The administration would like to just transfer them to maximum security prisons in the U.S., but the Congress won't allow them to do it. So it's going to be difficult to close Guantanamo. And Guantanamo was where we tortured prisoners. I mean, it's a stain on our honor. For God's sakes, I'd like to get it closed for that reason, if no other. And some of the other things that we've done, efforts to overthrow the Cuban government and so forth, that all has to end. And it will end. And I think with that, with the changes on the part of the United States, Cuba will begin to respond, and we will have a more constructive relationship.
That was Wayne Smith, a 25-year veteran of the U.S. State Department, who served as chief of mission at the U.S. Interest Section in Havana from 1978 to 1982. For more perspectives on the restoration of U.S.-Cuban relations, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Denise Manzari, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.